Welcome, welcome. And of course, like with everyone, Bill was willing to be involved. He was willing to read the book and was willing to think about this, and that's all I think we can ask of anyone, and that they do it at their own pace. I think you're probably wanting to hear Bob instead of me. I just will say he's an award-winning journalist. You're probably aware of that. This is his fourth book. And Mad in America, 10 years ago, brought him into, he's a medical journalist. And I love the story about how he didn't go looking for any of this. He just went looking for information to support what he was writing about. And that's what brought him here. I want to say that not only does he write a very readable book about a subject that's so complex, but also he's a very compassionate, generous, caring man. I really, his message of hope is not only one that he states in the book, it's one that he carries with him all the time. And so I just am so delighted, Bob, to have you here. So please welcome Bob Whitaker.
Beginning to think I need an apartment in Portland. This is about the third time. No, it's really an honor being here. I have to tell you, this is for me a very special night and a very optimistic night. I started writing about this really about 10 years ago when I was doing writing for Mad in America. So that book came out in 2002, did a lot of talks. This book came out in April. And when I was writing the solutions section of Anatomy of an Epidemic, and you can see it right in the last thing, I said, what was my hope for this book? My hope was that it would stir a discussion and that people would come forth from all different walks of life, family members, people who are involved in the delivery of services, people who use, people with lived experiences, psychiatrists, etc. And they would sort of look at this information and we would have this big picture, big discussion about, are what we're doing right now as a society, is it working well? In what ways is it working? And in what ways can it be improved and changed? And I loved Bill's opening remarks. It was so perfect, actually. I thought he put the context absolutely right. And so why I am so optimistic and thrilled here is, for whatever reason, here, I have been traveling around, but it was people in Oregon that really said, they started reading the book and they started to saying, well, what can we do? They asked that question. How can we respond? And they have responded in a really vigorous, important way, and in a way of the desire to make change ultimately, to think this thing through in a sort of collective fashion and see how we can do things better. So first of all, I want to say thank all of you for coming, because now you're part of this sort of discussion, and that's really what it is about. And I just want to say one other thing. So we're having this discussion here tonight. There's the group that put it on is a nice group in terms of, if you look at who's coming together, it is people who, again, that people who've had lived experiences, people who've been treated, people who are involved with treating, family members, and you have this richness of perspective that I think really is always needed and can lead to a good end. And even beyond that, so we are having this great venue tonight, and this is all part of starting this discussion. There's also a conference tomorrow that will begin, a two-day conference. It really is being organized, and it was being led by people here in Oregon. And people have flown in from around the country to have this discussion. And the discussion is, okay, what do we do well, and what can we do better? So I think this is such a note of optimism, so thank you. This is really a rewarding moment for me. Real quickly, in terms of the discussion, sort of framing this discussion and how it's framed in the book. One of the things we want to look at, first of all, is, sort of what is the common belief system? What is our common understanding about sort of the progress of psychiatry or of how we treat people? And the common understanding sort of goes like this, or not sort of. If you read conventional histories of psychiatry, The story is that Thorazine arrives in asylum medicine in 1955, and that kicks off a psychopharmacological revolution, this great leap forward in the care of those with mental disorders. Okay, and that drug is named as an antipsychotic, and think of the word, antipsychotic. It's like an antibiotic. It's a specific treatment for a disease. That's the in that name. Then we get antidepressants, and that's another group of these new drugs that are apparently antidotes to a disease. Okay, and so if you continue this story, this conventional story is, we get this first wave of drugs. It makes it possible to empty the state mental hospitals. And then in 1987, we get a second generation of drugs. This arrives with Prozac, the first SSRI antidepressant. Those antidepressants replace the tricyclics, and those are said to be safer and more efficacious than the first generation. Then we get atypical antipsychotics, drugs like Zyprexa and Risperdal. Those are said to be better than the older drugs, older antipsychotics like Thorazine and Haldol. So it's this story, and we are told in the last 20 years that these drugs fix chemical imbalances in the brain. And if that's true, if they do indeed fix chemical imbalances in the brain, that usually is a story of medical progress. So if you look at the great leaps forward in medicine, it's when they identify, so often it's when they identify a pathology and then they're able to fix that pathology or design a drug in response, okay? So anyway, that story writ large is a story of great progress. And you can read, U.S. Surgeon General David Satcher in 1998 produced a long report on mental health. And here's what he said. He said that prior to 1955, prior to Thorazine, we lacked treatments to prevent people from becoming chronically ill. Then we got this vast array of safe and effective treatments, and now we can prevent this chronicity in most people. Okay? That's the story of medical progress. And by the way, in the past 20 years since the arrival of SSRIs, we have embraced this in a big way. So, for example, in 1987, our country spent about $800 million on psychiatric medications. In 2007, it was $40 billion. So there is this extraordinary increase. And also, if you look at the expansion of the market, something like, or the use of these drugs, something like 10% of all children, 0 to 18, now take a psychiatric drug in the United States. So that is quite a societal embrace of this form of care. In adults, I can't quite figure out what the percentage of adults is, but I think it's at least 15% today. So we really have embraced this paradigm of care. Okay, so what I did as a starting point, just to question this, is it really, have we had this great advance? Is this paradigm of care really working for us? The first thing I did is just look at disability rates in our society due to mental illness. And by disability rates, people who in one way or another are under government care, okay? And the way that other people have tracked this metric from 1955 forward, and there can be a problem in a small way, but let's just do what they have done. In 1955, they say those under government care because they were, quote, disabled by mental illness, were in state and mental hospitals, okay? And so in 1955, there were 560,000 people in state and county mental hospitals. But you need to dig into those numbers a bit, because it turns out at that time, there were a number of people there that really weren't there for what conditions we would say were our psychiatric conditions. There were people there with end-stage syphilis, Alzheimer's disease. They served as nursing homes in many cases. So there were really 360,000 people with a psychiatric diagnosis in those hospitals at that time. Now you take the population, and that's a disability rate of 1 in 480 people, roughly. So that's our baseline rate as this revolution unfolds, okay? Now, after that, we do decide as a society to try to deinstitutionalize our mental hospitals, and we say we're gonna care for those with serious mental illness in the community, right? And so what happens is we set up basically a disability system, SSI and SSDI. These are federal government programs where if you are disabled for whatever reason, you can get this federal support, okay? And what other researchers have done and said, if you want to track the number of disabled mentally ill in our society, you have to then look at the SSI and SSDI numbers. okay, going forward in modern times. Now, there can be a little bit of a problem with this. It may be that it's a little bit of an apples to oranges comparison, but nevertheless, let's go forward with it. So in 1987, and this is the moment Prozac arrives in the market, there were 1.25 million people on SSI or SSDI because of a mental illness. That's why they were declared eligible. And that's a disability rate of around 1 in 184. Okay, so we went from 1 in 480 to 1 in 100 and roughly 84. Now, there may be some problems, like I said, in comparing that metric, but now let's just compare from 1987 to 2007. Our spending on psychiatric medications rose from 800 million to 40 billion in that time. The number of people on disability from 1987 to 2007 tripled. It went from 1.25 million to 4 million adults. And I don't know how many, so you can see a beginning of a question arising. Why are we seeing this rise in the number of people on disability? And that disability rate in 1987, in 2007, is down to about 1 in 75. So you see, excuse me, as this revolution has unfolded, we are seeing a rising disability rate. So at the very least, it raises a question, I think. And how many people do you think we have here? I don't know. Do we have like 300-400 people here? Does that sound about right? 400 people. The number of people going on disability every day in the United States, adults, due to mental illness, is 850 people per day, 365 days a year. So imagine two auditoriums this full, that's how many people are going on to disability. And that's why I call it the epidemic. It's at the very least, it shows you that we need to pay attention to this and ask questions about what's going on. Now, how about children, just for a second? In children in 1987, there were 16,200 children who received an SSI payment because they were disabled, you know, they were considered seriously ill due to a mental illness. 16,200. Today, it's 600,000. So this is 35-fold increase. The number of children going on to disability now every day in the United States due to mental illness is 250 children per day. That's the scope of this sort of epidemic we need to talk about. And if you follow those children forward to age 18, they are going right on to lifetime, long-term disability, many of them. And it's like this pathway has opened up in our society where kids do get diagnosed, they get treated, and next thing you know, they sort of have this career as a mental patient stretching out before them. And just so you know, in terms of societal cost, I did some back of the envelope calculations, like that child that goes on at age 18, that youth, what's it going to cost to support that person? What's going to be well over $1 million? So you can just see as from a societal sort of point of view, the burden of mental illness has not decreased in our society as the psychopharmacological revolution has unfolded. For whatever reason, it is increasing at a rapid rate. In terms of spending on mental disorders, on mental health services, in 2001, it was we spent about $85 billion on mental health services in this country. In 2007, we spent $170 billion. So we doubled it in 7 years. And now if the federal government had a report recently, if you look at medical expenditure, spending on mental health services is the fastest growing concern. So I think you're beginning to see the scope of the puzzle and why we do need to address this. And here's how I set up the puzzle in the book, and I really want to echo what Bill said. Do we know that medications help many people in times of acute distress? Yes, we do. Do we all know people who are on medications and doing well? Yes, we do. But nevertheless, so we know that the medications can help, but nevertheless, we have this disability, rising disability at the time of rising use of medications. And so, having set that puzzle up in the book, I'm asking these questions. I really want to address. First of all, do these drugs fix chemical imbalances in the brain? Is that true? Is that belief system we have, is it an accurate one? Because also that becomes the rationale for long-term consistent use, because they're like insulin for diabetes. We want to know if that's true. The second thing that this book does, and I really think it's the first effort to really do it, is try to look at how did the medication shape long-term outcomes in the aggregates? In other words, are we improving the course of schizophrenia in the aggregates? Are we doing that for anxiety? Are we doing that for depression? And are we doing it for manic depressive illness? And again, the thing is, you want to look sort of the collection of outcomes, okay? And hopefully what we're going to see is that we are, but this is a question that really hasn't been addressed before. And I can talk a little bit about how I do it, but that's really the heart of the book, to really try to bring that information forward. And then the final question I'm really asking in this book is this. Is it possible that you can take people who have a milder problem, say a mild bout of depression, and they get treated with an antidepressant? Will there be a certain percentage of people that maybe have an adverse reaction to that or a bad reaction to the antidepressant? Say they might have a manic episode or even a psychotic episode or whatever. And once that happens, do they get pushed into the bipolar category, which is a much more serious diagnosis? And the reason you need to ask this question and why you want to ask this question is this. Bipolar illness used to be called manic depressive illness. It used to be fairly rare. So if you look at prevalence numbers for manic depressive illness in, say, 1950s, it was about 1 in 5,000 people, adults. Today it's 1 in 50. So there's a 100-fold increase, roughly, in the prevalence of bipolar illness. So if we really want to figure out this epidemic, we have to figure out where are all the bipolar patients coming from. So those are the three questions in the book, and obviously I don't have time to go through it in great detail, but I'll sort of hit some highlights and then I'll get off the stage as fast as possible because there are some panel members that I am really eager to hear here. Quickly, the chemical imbalance story, where did that arise? The chemical imbalance theory of mental disorders arose actually in the 1960s, and it arose from an understanding of how medications act on the brain. It did not arise from investigations of people so diagnosed. It arose from understanding in a very specific way, first of all, how antipsychotics affect the brain. So we had Thorazine and Haldol, and I'll explain this in a second a bit more, but what they learned was that those drugs block dopamine transmission in the brain. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter, right? So they learned that they blocked it, thwarted it, decreased that transmission. So then they hypothesized that people with schizophrenia had too much dopamine in the brain, okay? But the hypothesis arose basically to explain why the drugs might work, not because of what they found in people with schizophrenia, okay? And then let's just go ahead a little bit with depression. So you've heard the story about that people with depression have low serotonin, right? We've all heard that. That arose from understanding how antidepressants act on the brain, all right? And then they hypothesized the opposite. So real quickly, since we've all heard about, I'll do the story with antidepressants, since we've all heard the story. So Prozac is known as a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, right? So here's how Prozac works. You have a presynaptic neuron. Neurons have to communicate in the brain, right? So a presynaptic neuron will release serotonin into a small gap called a synaptic cleft between that and a postsynaptic neuron. And this is a way to communicate a message from the presynaptic neuron to the postsynaptic neuron. That serotonin enters the synaptic cleft and it binds with receptors on this postsynaptic neuron, okay? Now that message has to be, it needs to be short and quick. So the brain has to remove that serotonin from the synaptic cleft really fast to end the message. Now, the way it removes the serotonin, it does it in one of two ways. It either has an enzyme that comes along and metabolizes the serotonin and carts it off as waste, as metabolites, or it is taken back up into the presynaptic neuron via reuptake channels. So what Prozac does, and the SSRIs, it blocks the reuptake channels. All right? So that keeps that serotonin longer in the synaptic cleft. And that's why they say it raises serotonin levels or raises that activity. So what people hypothesized, and this actually goes back before Prozac ever came to the market, was people with depression have low serotonin. I'm not going to go into the science of how they did that, but they began investigating that in 1970s, and they did not find that to be so. They did not find that people with depression had characteristically low amounts of serotonin. And as early as 1984, the NIMH concluded on an early investigation of this sort of serotonergic theory of depression. Elevations, this is in 1984, elevations or decrements in the functioning of serotonergic systems per se are not likely to be associated with depression. So they weren't finding low amounts. Long story, just to keep that going forward, Prozac comes to market. There was a lot of other investigations into serotonin. They just never found that as a matter of routine that people with depression had low serotonin. So for example, you can read Stephen Stahl. He's a molecular psychopharmacologist. He wrote a book called Essential Psychopharmacology in 2000, and he concludes, sums up this whole thing. There is no clear and convincing evidence that monoamine deficiency, serotonin is a monoamine, monoamine deficiency accounts for depression. That is, there is no real monoamine deficit. Okay, that's what he concluded in 2000. By the way, if you can do the same thing for this overactive dopamine system theory of schizophrenia, do they, as a matter of course, have overactive dopamine systems? They did not find that to be so. There may be some dopaminergic involvement in bursts when you have a psychotic episode, but as a customary thing, they did not find that to be so. So for example, Stephen Hyman, he was the director of the NIMH in the 90s. He's a neuroscientist. He says in a 2002 book, there is no compelling evidence that a lesion in the dopamine system is a primary cause of schizophrenia. Finally, in 2005, Kenneth Kendler, co-editor-in-chief of Psychological Medicine, writes this, of this whole long search for chemical imbalances. He says, we have hunted for big, simple neurochemical explanations for psychiatric disorders, and we have not found them. Now, what are the ramifications of this? The ramifications of this are, there's many, but one of the ramifications is, first of all, good medicine and a good societal sort of use of medications requires an honest understanding of what's going on. And there was just a paper out that surveyed Americans about their understanding of mental disorders, and 80% of Americans now know that depression is due to a chemical imbalance. 87% of Americans now know that schizophrenia is due to a chemical imbalance. Now, that is not a story of a society that has come to understand mental disorders. That is a story of a society that has become deluded about mental disorders. There's a couple other ramifications. I'm not saying that there might not be biological involvement. I actually think there is biological involvement many times with psychiatric problems. We just don't know what it is. Okay? That's the second thing. But the second thing is this. We have this belief system, you have to necessarily stay on medications for life because they're like insulin for diabetes, right? That becomes the rationale for long-term use. But that's a false rationale. These drugs are not like insulin for diabetes because they're not fixing any known problem. The next ramification is really a note of optimism. If people don't necessarily have a chemical imbalance, it may be that someone can have a bout of depression, get better, and just get on with it. It may be true with psychosis. You may have environmental stresses, you may stop sleeping, you may have a bout of psychosis. With the proper care, you may be able to recover, and maybe you need medications for sometimes. But it's not even that you're going to be in recovery from a mental illness. You can just be recovered in some times, okay? Because that's the possibility of hope that you see in this, okay? Anyway, this is part of the discussion I think we need to have. We need to think honestly about what we know about mental disorders. And unfortunately, the brain being this extraordinarily complex place, it just has not given up its mystery, so to speak, in terms of really what are, quote, biological pathways for these different disorders. So I actually think this is a note of optimism that opens up a lot of different possibilities of care and recovery, et cetera. One other thing. We like to think that the chemical imbalance story is, it helps reduce stigma, right? That's what we say. Well, you will find, actually, that as this understanding has happened, stigma is increasing. So they did a survey recently about people, would you live next door to someone with a psychiatric disorder? And increasingly, people say no, especially if it's with schizophrenia. So it's actually increasing some sense of fear of people as opposed to reducing it. Whereas I think if we have this sense of we really do not know what's going on with psychiatric disorders, we don't know that people have broken brains, and that's a false thing to sort of say, it brings a different sense. It really brings a sense of brethrenship, sort of the sense of who knows. People can descend into these states and have these difficulties, and they can suffer psychiatric distress, but so can all of us, perhaps, given the right, you know, the wrong stresses, the difficult stresses, etc. I actually think this notion increases the sense of a commonness, and really brings the sense that we are brethren, and we really want to have that sense of not, instead of it's not us over here that are, quote, not mentally ill, and over here are the mentally ill, it destroys that. And then we just see it's a sort of spectrum of possibilities, so to speak. Okay, real quickly, and then I got to get off the stage. So what do I do in this book? I look at long-term outcomes for schizophrenia, anxiety, depression, and bipolar disorder, and then I look what's happening with kids as well. Is the medicating of kids, is that going well long-term for those kids? Real quickly, let's go with schizophrenia real quickly. Why do we know? We believe as a society that you have to stay on these medications for life, and we even have a system of care designed to make sure that happens. What is the evidence base that supports the use of antipsychotics? It's of two types. You'll run short-term trials, so let's say you have people coming into an emergency room with psychotic symptoms. If you run trials where you treat one with drug, one with placebo, the drug-treated group will be doing better after 6 weeks, okay, on the target symptoms of psychosis, and that's a pretty robust evidence for short-term use of antipsychotics. Now, once those studies were done in the 60s and 70s, they asked this question, how long should people be on the medications? And they would run studies like this. They would take people that stabilized well on the medications. One group would be maintained on the drugs. The other group would be withdrawn, usually abruptly so. And those abruptly withdrawn would relapse at a higher rate, meaning the symptoms would return, as opposed to those maintained on the medications. So researchers said, aha, you take the drug away, people relapse. That shows that the drug prevents the return of symptoms. They prevent relapse. And that's the evidence base for maintaining people on medications long term. But that doesn't tell you a couple things. First of all, you got the problem that maybe the high relapse rate is due to the withdrawal, okay, and the speed of withdrawal. And second of all, it's not telling you, is that helping people go to work? And is it really changing the long-term course of, quote, schizophrenia or psychotic disorders? It tells you nothing about functioning. And in 2002, a guy named Emmanuel Stipp, who is a psychiatrist at the University of Montreal, he looked at the long-term literature for antipsychotics and he said this, do we really know after 50 years that these are effective over the long term? And he says, really there is no compelling evidence on the matter. And if we really want to take a closer look at this, we bear the risk of seeing some real surprises. So that's what he said in 2002. And that set me off on, can I figure out how are these medications shaping the long-term course? Real quickly on this, one of the first surprises you find, so the first thing I did is, if you go back with first episode schizophrenia patients from 1945 to 1955, what were their outcomes? This is before we had Thorazine. And you start to see something pretty optimistic. 70% would be discharged within 12 to 15 months. And at the end of 3-5 years, 70% or so would be living in the community, and they weren't on disability because we didn't have those things, those systems. So we have this sense that schizophrenia back then, nobody got better. That's not true. Many, many people got better. And the employment rates for those first episode patients from 1945 to 55, higher than 50%. So that actually is a moment of some hope, right? I'm going to bounce really quickly through the research literature on this. The first long-term study was done in the of any sort was a one-year study done by the NIMH in the early 1960s, and it had four arms. Three groups were treated with drug. The fourth arm was treated with placebo. Now, after 6 weeks, the drug-treated groups were doing better. After 1 year, they did notice something odd. They noticed that for whatever reason, those treated with drug as a group in the hospital at a higher rehospitalization rate. There's a little bit of a sense here that maybe you're even predisposing people to greater chronicity. But the most important thing is this, is what was the employment rate in that early time of the year? 58% were employed after 1 year in that large group of patients, and 54% were self-supporting. Two-thirds of the women were functioning okay in the role of a domestic role. This is the 1960s, okay? This is a high level of function. I just want you to read what the NIMH researchers concluded at the end of 1 year. And this is not necessarily medicated patients or unmedicated patients. This is for the group as a whole. Some are off meds, some are on. The ex-hospitalized schizophrenic is more likely to be employed than not after 1 year, and if employed, is more likely to be working at a level equal to his best before hospitalization and getting on with his coworkers. So what do we see at this early moment? I'm just trying to instill this possibility, some sort of robust recovery, right? We're seeing that in the literature. Two other studies I'm going to talk about with schizophrenia, and then we'll move on real quickly to a couple others. In 1978 to 1981, a gentleman named Martin Harrell, he's a psychologist at the University of Illinois, began following a large group of patients diagnosed either with schizophrenia or, 1 minute left, psychosis, okay, or other psychotic disorders. And he just followed them up at 2 years, 4.5, 7.5, 10, and 15, okay? And then he saw, were they in, I'm going to take 3 minutes. And he was going to say, are they in recovery? Are they working? And are they taking medications? And here was his outcomes. At the end of 2 years, let's say in the schizophrenia group, those off medication were doing a little bit better than those on medication. At the end of 4.5 years, the off medication group between year two and year 4.5 continued to get better, such that at the end of 4.5 years, 40% of those off medication were in recovery versus 5% of those on medication. And that difference stayed the same throughout the 15 years. So there was a much higher recovery rate for those off meds. There can be many reasons for that, but at least you can see in that possibility that some people diagnosed with schizophrenia can get better and just do well. And over half of those off meds were working. In terms of the other psychotic disorders group, same sort of thing. And on the whole, it was that group that did much better long term. That's one thing you find. The second thing you find is that of those who got off, in the aggregate, they had really good outcomes. They were sort of in a recovered category, high employment rates, sort of lower rates of people suffering with symptoms. So what I'm telling you in that literature, and this is part of the discussion we need to have, is this idea that all people need to be on medications all their life, it's not reflected in the literature. And maybe what you need is a paradigm of care that uses medications in a more selective fashion. And the beauty of this is there's some people that clearly can really do well, get off, and just get on with their lives, whether it be milder psychotic disorders or schizophrenia. Last thing, and then I am going to get off. There's a group in Finland in 1992 in Western Lapland that began using medications with their first episode psychotic patients in a different way. They began delaying initial use of antipsychotics, and the thought was, if we throw a lot of resources at people at that first break, can we help them get back on their feet without medicating them with antipsychotics? And they would use sleeping aids. They might use benzodiazepines to help people go to sleep. And they found that often they could. And they began using antipsychotic medications in a selective manner. They delayed initial use. If persons didn't start getting better, then they would use the medications for a period of time. And then those who were exposed, they would have a further sense who could go off successfully and who needed to stay on the medications. It's sort of a selective best use model. And here are their results at the end of 5 years. They now have, by far, the best reported results you'll see in the Western world. 80% of their first episode psychotic patients are either working or back in school at the end of 5 years. Only 20% have gone on to long-term disability. In terms of antipsychotic medication use, about one-third have been exposed to antipsychotic medication during that five-year period, and about 20% are regularly maintained on the drugs. So what's the point of this story? The point of this story is that, and this conference is being called a medication optimization conference, is maybe if we have this conversation, We can learn to use these medications in a more selective, cautious, thoughtful manner and figure out for whom and for when and for how long, and then we can block this disability rates, we can stop this epidemic, and we can really start having systems of care that promote robust long-term recovery. And that's the hope here. So thank you for the time. Sorry I went over long. Thank you.